It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we find out how to transition to a more eco-friendly lifestyle without incurring stress, and maybe we can save some pennies in the process.
Yesterday, the FBI announced the rescue of 168 child sex trafficking victims and arrested 281 pimps in cities across the country. 12 of those arrested were in Milwaukee. 6 children were rescued in Wisconsin.
The arrests were part of the annual enforcement push known as Operation Cross Country. This is the 8th such week-long operation. Operation Cross Country is part of the FBI's Innocence Lost National Initiative. It was established in 2003 in coordination with the Department of Justice and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to address the problem of child prostitution.
Here to talk about child sex trafficking in the United States is Bridget Carr. She's the director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. Bridget, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with an overview of Operation Cross Country. How does the FBI go about carrying on such a big coordinated effort like this one?
Well, so much of child sex trafficking and really human sex trafficking overall takes place on the internet. And so law enforcement can monitor a lot of what's happening. And so they do these operations every year or so and are able to take down a number of pimping organizations.
And the FBI announced that they arrested 281 pimps as part of this operation, rescued around 170 victims. How big a dent do numbers like those make in the overall effort to put sex traffickers out of business?
Well, sadly, we don't really know the prevalence of human trafficking or sex trafficking in America today. We don't keep track of the numbers very well. And the numbers you just cited give us an example of that. Of the almost 300 pimps that they arrested, one of the questions I always have is how many of those are women who are 18, 19, 20, who, if this operation had happened a month or a year ago, would have been in the victim category. It's a troubling reality of anti-trafficking work in America today that, you know, if you get caught before you turn some magic number, you may be considered a victim. But if you're 18 or above, you're probably going to be considered a criminal.
You said we don't really know how big a problem child sex trafficking is in this country, but we can triangulate a little bit, I'm guessing, based on some of the figures we do know. Can you give us a sense about how widespread it is?
We really can't, because I can tell you right now that a number of those victims, 16 and 17-year-olds who were found in the operation this week, if they were in Michigan, for example, and had been encountered by a state or local law enforcement in Michigan at 16 or 17, would have been charged as prostitutes under our state law. And each state differs in what age they view someone a prostitute or potentially a victim of child sex trafficking. So you can't really figure out the data points from that, because you essentially have 50 different state systems regulating prostitution, keeping track of data in different ways. It wasn't until a couple of years ago, even, that the Uniform Crime Reporting System for the FBI included trafficking as its own category.
Hmm. Well, what about safe harbor laws? Do those come into play?
So safe harbor laws mean different things to different constituencies. For someone like me, I hope that means immunity, that we treat victims of sex trafficking, specifically child victims, as victims of sexual abuse. However, the way it's interpreted by states can be very different. There are states that say they have safe harbor, and it just means that they have an affirmative defense for kids. There are states that say they have safe harbor, and it means that they have a presumption of victimization as long as you comply with court-ordered services. I hope that we get to a point in the U.S. where safe harbor means that you're treated as a victim of sexual abuse if you are a child sex trafficking victim.
Do you think there needs to be one uniform national standard for what safe harbor means?
That would be nice, but in our federalist system, we can't regulate it in that way. The federal government can, you know, provide some incentives, but it's really going to require the type of paradigm shift that we saw with domestic violence. And state by state, we're going to have a much deeper understanding of what sex trafficking is. And the most important understanding is that we really need to focus our attention on the perpetrators and the buyers, on their thoughts, actions, and decisions, and not on the victims. Right now, the spotlight is on, well, did she make bad choices? Did she return to her pimp too many times? And, you know, if we would be having those conversations about people who are raped without money or about victims of domestic violence, that would be frowned upon. But in the sex trafficking world, that is accepted right now.
Now, we spoke to Cindy McCain, wife of Senator John McCain, not long ago this year. It's one of her personal missions to fight sex trafficking. And she talked about one of the important things being to educate people about what trafficking looks like, in particular airlines she was focusing on. But what do we know about what it looks like if people want to take part and try to help?
Well, right now in America, we tend to think that it looks very foreign and very exotic, that it looks like the movie Taken. It's much more mundane than that. It's often about, you know, it's about traffickers targeting vulnerable people. And if those vulnerable people for child sex trafficking victims are people who may be poor, they may come from broken homes, and they're looking for what pimps often offer them, which is love, acceptance. And so if we keep looking for this very foreign, you know, foreign individuals brought in and kept chained to a radiator, we're going to miss most of the sex trafficking that's happening around us.
And when these kids are rescued, as in the operation with the FBI, what kind of shape do they generally come in as psychologically speaking?
Well, it's really hard. I mean, for many victims of child sex trafficking, they are angry about being rescued. They want to return to their pimp. They may believe that they are in love with that person. And so when we have a narrative in the United States that these victims should be grateful and should act accordingly, I often say we have sort of the Lifetime movie version of victims as the narrative. And then when victims don't behave that way, we often then think, well, then they're not victims. And we have to stop putting expectations on victims. Victims are victims because of what happened to them, not because of how they behave.
And what happens when the kids have been rescued? What sorts of services are available to them to help them reacclimate with families, maybe, in society again?
For U.S. citizen victims, it's really a state-by-state determination about what benefits are available. So, for example, in Michigan, child victims of sex trafficking cannot be put in the child protection system as victims of sexual abuse. If they get into that system at all, it's often through a juvenile delinquency route, and that is in and of itself problematic. In Illinois, they can go in as victims of sexual abuse. So again, there are probably 50 varieties of the types of services available for these victims.
So there's lots of different approaches to treatment and the way sex trafficking victims are seen in the eyes of the state. But can you give us an example of a state that you think is doing good things when it comes to handling child sex trafficking victims?
I think Illinois is doing some really wonderful things. They have categorized child sex trafficking victims as victims of sexual abuse. They are trying to put in place the right support systems, and they have some universities who are working on trying to study really evidence-based approaches to serving these victims. The real dilemma is that while we're happy to talk about human trafficking nationwide, no one is doing the really hard work of figuring out evidence-based ways of treating the types of trauma these individuals have experienced.
So what would you like to see people doing in terms of the hard work you're talking about?
You know, I would like to see people trying new approaches, being willing to fail, but most importantly, being willing to evaluate it. Too often we see in the human trafficking space people giving out really good sound bites that aren't backed up. Sometimes this work is quite mundane and not very sexy, and so we need to take some quiet time and really figure out what works, and more importantly, what doesn't work, so that when we are doing these types of operations that have just happened, that when the victims come out, we have something to offer them that can actually help them.
What would you like listeners to know about child sex trafficking that they may not?
You know, I think the most important thing that I want listeners to know is that child sex trafficking victims only exist because there are buyers in your community. And that's the thing we never talk about. This operation doesn't happen if our husbands, dads, brothers, friends, and others weren't buying sex. And that's tough to hear and tough to think about, but that's the reality.
Bridget, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Bridget Carr, director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. Eco-living may be on the rise, but making the transition to a greener lifestyle can create stress and guilt, making some people give up before they've tried.
It doesn't have to be that way, our next guest says. Having lived through some shame and fear of never feeling green enough, she's gathered some simple strategies to make the process doable and to save some money along the way.
Madeline Somerville is the author of All You Need Is Less, which she calls an eco-friendly guide to guilt-free green living. She blogs at sweetmadeline.ca. Madeline, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did you decide to embark on this journey of doing more with less?
Well, it started about a decade ago. My husband and I moved to British Columbia, Canada, which is sort of known up here as the hippie province. And a few years later, we got a dog, and I remember bringing him home, and he was this chubby little adorable puppy, and he flopped on the floor and started licking our floor, our kitchen floor. And I realized that that was the same floor that I had mopped with this chemical cleaner a few hours earlier. And I started just looking at the products I was using in my home and on my body and realizing that I didn't know a whole lot about the ingredients that were in them or what the effects were. And so from there, I started to do what I think a lot of people do as their first step. And I started buying green cleaners and, eco-friendly shampoos and that kind of thing. And it got really expensive because those things tend to be, it seems like they're 2 to 3 times the price of their regular alternatives. And then it kind of got frustrating because I realized that some of the stuff that was being labeled as eco-friendly wasn't. And I had a moment where I was looking at the ingredients on this laundry detergent, and I decided to look them up, and I realized that they were things that were readily accessible to me and that I could actually make it myself. And that by doing that, I knew exactly what was going into it. I knew exactly where it was coming from. It was way less expensive, and I could adjust it if I needed to, if I wanted it to have less fragrance or a different fragrance or, you know, more soap or less soap. And that was kind of like the aha moment for me, was realizing that I could create these things in a really simple way and a less expensive way, and that I didn't have to go and buy them.
Let's set you along the road, and then you hit some other challenges along the way. Tell us how you convinced your husband to start composting.
Well, the town that we lived in was a very small town called Squamish, BC, and it had bears. Like, it was civilized, but bears would regularly stroll through your backyard. So backyard composting wasn't really something that many people did. And so our town had set up a compost center at the same place that you drop off your bottles. And I decided it was time that we started composting. I'm a vegetarian, so we had tons of fruit and veggie scraps, and they were just going in the garbage. And composting is one of the biggest ways that you can reduce the waste that's coming out of your house. So I decided that we were going to do this. And I made that executive decision. And I didn't want fruit flies in this compost bin, so I decided I would start storing them in my freezer. So I started hoarding fruit and vegetable scraps in our freezer, and wasn't maybe always the most prompt about taking them to the depot. And my husband, it was like this routine in my house where I would feel, you know, super good about myself and be patting myself on the back for composting. And meanwhile, I was just storing fruit and veggie scraps in our freezer until my husband would like throw them out in a fit of rage because he could never find anything because we had garbage in our freezer. And so that was sort of like this moment that I think a lot of people run into, where you may be super gung-ho about going green and doing all these eco-friendly things, and your partner or your coworkers or your roommate is just not into it for whatever reason. So we had to troubleshoot that a little bit and tweak the routine, which involved him sort of getting on board with it as long as I was more conscientious about taking stuff in a more prompt manner, so our freezer was actually being used for food rather than compost.
I can just imagine that. What's for dinner? Let's look in the freezer. Oh, my God. And it's just this, like, bag of glop.
Yeah, and it was just, I mean, I can't blame him, but there was definitely some conversations where it was like, why do you hate Mother Nature? Why aren't you helping me? So I think that's something that a lot of people run into. And it's not something I ever saw addressed in the eco-friendly books. Like, it just seemed like everyone had these perfect partners who were like, oh, you want to give up your fridge? Of course, let's go for it. And that was just not what I encountered. And I knew I wasn't the only one. I hope to God I wasn't the only one.
Let's talk about that, because there tends to be sometimes, you know, some guilt that comes along with these lifestyles. And sometimes people are doing it out of guilt, but it seems like a hassle and they feel like they're not doing enough of it, or their neighbor has 4 compost bins plus rain barrels. I mean, how do you just do what you can and be okay with that?
I think it comes from, first of all, just stopping the judging. And that's a huge thing, because I even get criticism anytime I post an article on any website. There's always comments going, you know, oh, but you're using this and that has been linked to the, and it's like, you can never be green enough, and there's always somebody judging you. And we judge ourselves really harshly too. So even me, like I obviously try and live a very green lifestyle, but I'm not a huge cook. And so I often am like beating myself up because I'm not cooking as much and I should be doing things from scratch. The key is to stop. And one of the biggest things that you can do to be eco-friendly is also one of the easiest, and it's just to stop consuming and to really reduce the amount that you're buying. and just sort of question everything to the point where, do I really need this? What's going to happen to it when I'm done with it? Sort of slow things down to the point where you can actually look at your life and maybe put a pause button on this whole cycle of consume and throw out and consume and throw out. And once you've sort of hit that pause button, just look around and see what changes you are excited about making. You know, someone might not be super excited to use a clothesline, which I really love, but they might be really excited to make their own food or start canning. And so that's a really good place to start, is some place that you're excited to take it on. And then just make really small, gradual changes. Like, I think in order for this to be sustainable, it needs to be small and it needs to be gradual. So rather than, you know, somebody reading my book and then tearing through their house, throwing everything out and buying all new, you know, everything else, like it just needs to be, you know, when your toothpaste runs out, maybe try the recipe for homemade toothpaste and see if you like it. And if you don't, that's totally fine. You can go back to regular toothpaste, and I list an organization that will recycle the tubes. Or, you know, maybe next time when you run out of window cleaner, you can try this recipe. Like, just do it really gradually and focus on what you are doing rather than sort of comparing yourself and beating yourself up about what you're not doing, because that's a really easy cycle to get into.
Well, I'd love to check out a couple of the recipes you mentioned. Let's, how about that toothpaste? How do we make our own?
Okay, so the toothpaste is one that I found personally, like, a little bit, it took a bit of an adjustment because it's way less sweet than a lot of our toothpaste, which might sound funny, but it's a really basic mix of peppermint oil, baking soda, and water, and you basically just mix it together and you get a fine paste. And baking soda is a really great gentle abrasive. And when I first started using this, as I said, it was a little bit, like, it's a little bit saltier than normal toothpaste. And now I'm at the point where when I use regular toothpaste, it almost tastes like icing sugar or something. It tastes weird to me. But when I started using it, I started wondering if the baking soda was harming the teeth enamel, because it does seem like it's grittier than normal toothpaste. So I did some research, and it actually scores, dentists use this fancy thing called this relative dentin abrasiveness scale. And baking soda clocks in at a 7. It goes from 0 to 200, the scale. And baking soda clocks in at a 7, and then the nearest commercial toothpaste comes in at a 35. Huh. So even though you feel, because it's a manual abrasive rather than a chemical abrasive, you feel it more, but it's way more gentle on your teeth. There's no packaging associated with it aside from the baking soda box.
And it works? You're not getting cavities? Your teeth aren't falling out?
It took me a while to admit to my dentist that I was doing this, because I always, you know, sometimes you just don't want to get into the whole, like, I don't want to preach, and I just don't want to get into the whole shebang when I'm sitting there with my mouth propped open. But when I finally confessed to my dentist, he's like, I always get comments that my teeth are very strong, like, I don't have, you know, my teeth are nice, I think. And it gives you that kind of shiny, slippery, slick feeling you get from the dentist. Like, it feels amazing. And it's something that's a really easy thing for most people to try. Like, most people have baking soda and water in their house, and peppermint essential oil or peppermint extract is something you can easily find in the baking aisle.
Well,
so it's sort of a low risk thing to try.
Let's look at another one. You mentioned making your own shampoo and conditioner. Those seem like hard things to pull off. Toothpaste, maybe, but, you know, there's so many hair care products out there now that do so much. How does this work, and does it work on your hair?
This is the most bizarre thing I've ever, like, the most strange green thing I've ever tried, and the thing I get the most questions on. And it's also literally almost the easiest recipe in the whole book. To make your own shampoo, what you're basically doing is you're mixing a cup of warm water with a tablespoon of baking soda. So you mix that together until the baking soda is dissolved. Hop in the shower. When you've got wet hair, you pour this mixture over your head and really massage it into your scalp. It's not going to foam because it doesn't have sodium lauryl sulfate, which is one of the more dangerous chemicals that is in a lot of foaming products like toothpastes and shampoos. So it's not going to foam, but you're basically just going to concentrate on your scalp. If you've got oily hair, you want to concentrate along the hairline and along the crown of your head. Once you've sort of rubbed that all in, you just rinse it out. The conditioner is same thing, very simple. It's one cup of warm water with 1 to 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar mixed in. And apple cider vinegar has a strong smell, and this recipe isn't in the book, but somebody alerted it to me, and I've tried it, and it works, is that you can also substitute fresh lemon juice, which, for people who object to the apple cider vinegar smell, lemon juice is great. So 1 cup of warm water, 1 to 2 tablespoons of either apple cider vinegar or lemon juice, and once you're shampoo rinse is out of your hair. You put that in your hair, you let it sit for a few minutes, just like regular conditioner, rinse that out. It's the most amazing thing. It doesn't seem like it should work because I, too, spent years spending ridiculous amounts on these salon shampoos and conditioners, but my hair was always fluffy and light and, like, tangle-free.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Madeline, thank you so much for joining us and sharing these recipes.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, and try them. They're fantastic.
We've been talking with Madeline Somerville. She's the author of All You Need Is Less. Our next guest takes a deep look at political ambition in the United States, what separates the people from their elected representatives, why we're suspicious of people with political ambition, and how we're not living up to our role as citizens.
Jeffrey Becker is with us now. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of the Pacific. His new book is called Ambition in America, Political Power and the Collapse of Citizenship. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me on your show, Rob.
So your book is about citizens and the people who want to represent them. Let's start with the citizens. You write, I'm quoting here, amid the celebration of individual ambition, Americans seem to have lost the ambition to be citizens. And I love that phrase, the ambition to be citizens. What would that look like? What is the ambition to be a citizen?
Well, what I was struck by was the way in which we often talk about how citizens do not participate in American politics, or alternatively, how elected officials might abuse their power. But what we miss is that in-between concept of people actually participating in daily life, people participating by running for elected office, and we don't really encourage political ambition in ways that support democracy. Americans will openly praise people with ambition in private life. We celebrate people as celebrities, entrepreneurs, but we don't trust people who show ambition in public life. We do encourage citizens to vote, but we do not train, nor do we encourage citizens to run for political office. And as I've quoted another person, Joseph Schlesinger, saying, a political system unable to kindle ambitions for office is in as much danger of breaking down as one unable to restrain ambitions.
Did we lose that kind of positive citizen ambition along the way somewhere, or did we never really develop it in the first place?
I think it comes in ebbs and flows. I think there have been moments where citizens have tried to organize collectively, where what it meant to participate locally means more than what we have now. And I write about this in talking about periods in American history where political ambition was of citizens was thwarted, where citizens organize themselves to participate in politics, to take control of a civic life that they thought they were losing control of, but they ended up ultimately undermining themselves. And so it's a story in this book where what we have is we've celebrated individuals. We praise that individual who wants to make a difference, but we don't really cultivate a way of people working together or working collectively. Public office has to be worthy of people ambitions. And when you ask people today, do you want to run for public office? Often they don't want to. They look at the scrutiny a candidate goes through, and that's not something a lot of people want. So it's a complex story, and I think the story that I'm trying to tell is a way in which that what gives people dignity has departed in this much, or it's moved away from public life.
And yeah, it's in that phrase I quoted, the celebration of individual ambition. So I'll represent the citizen here. I'm more interested in personal fulfillment, personal, maybe financial success, instead of maybe at the expense of embracing the duties of a citizen.
Well, that's precisely what we've had. We have people who celebrate personal wealth, and they see personal wealth as a way of satisfaction. It's a way in which things matter. Democratic life is hard. You get a tangible reward when you work for a job that pays you well. When you spend a lot of time working on legislation or working collectively with others, you don't always get what you want. You don't always get to guarantee the outcome. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we have a celebration of individuals that don't make room for the contributions or smaller contributions of people at the local level, or at least what we reward people for is that individual celebrity. We have a lot of people who want to be famous, but we don't have a lot of people who really want to participate in the sort of the nuts and bolts workings of daily life.
And we can point toward a lot of political movements where people get involved, but based on what you're talking about, I wonder, are there... is there a negative way to be involved in politics? I'm active now only because I see my individual rights being infringed on, as opposed to maybe a positive way of being involved. I'm active because I want to get together with fellow citizens and shape the future of the country.
Yes, I think there is. I have a fear that we may be coming to a point where an elected official who is only concerned about his or her career, puts their own celebrity above a larger good, the good of the country. I think that the healthy ambition that I argue for is an ambition that embraces a certain degree of thanklessness, a certain degree that you make your contribution, but you don't expect to be celebrated for it. You don't expect to be highly compensated for it, at least financially. And I think that's something that tears at the larger fabric of what we reward in American politics. We have candidates who forward themselves for elected office, but they haven't really spent that time working in their local communities. Not all, some have, but we have that situation where, you know, candidates put themselves up because they have the money to run for office, not because they've been actively involved in communities at the local, state, county, or regional level.
Well, given, as you've said, that we as citizens are suspicious of politics, distrust it, don't want to do the dirty work of getting directly involved in running for office, who does that leave? Is it in that situation, is it only people interested in self-aggrandizement who are actually going to run for office? Is it that bad?
Well, I'm not sure it's quite that bad yet, but I look at what gets rewarded and the kinds of people who want that kind of recognition, and the question comes up, are these the people who are best qualified to govern? We increasingly see billionaires whose drive we admire putting themselves up as qualified candidates to be governors, qualified candidates to be senators, and yet it's not clear that the skills that lead somebody to be incredibly successful in business translate into the skills needed to govern. We don't necessarily like the imperious quality of somebody who is a corporate CEO who can make that quick decision. And a Democratic leader is somebody who has to forge compromises. So what we have are people who have made their success by not necessarily compromising. I look at a figure like Steve Jobs, talented CEO, but I'm not sure I want somebody like that as my governor.
Again, based on what you've said so far, though, if we don't trust politics or the politicians we see, there's a lot of appeal in somebody who we can see as an outsider. And in fact, a lot of people very deliberately try to run as outsiders outside of Washington, untainted by the political process.
Yes, that is precisely the appeal. And I think one of the cautions I have is that somebody like that appears as though they can solve all your problems. You could just turn your problems on to that person. I think a lot of people look at politicians this way as saviors from politics. And that, I think, teaches a very dangerous lesson about politics, which is politics is really about day-to-day interaction with the people you share a life with. And then when somebody comes in and says, we can solve all these problems, they sort of offer that easy solution, that there's some kind of simple solution to what are often difficult and intractable problems. We might not trust these politicians because they are making promises that couldn't possibly be fulfilled. I think that's increasingly what we're seeing as people who run for office by running against office. And that teaches us the lesson that, well, politics is a problem. It's not a way of life. It's something that needs to be resolved or solved or dispensed with.
Do you see more and more compromise, doing the dirty work, sometimes sacrificing principles to get something done? as being increasingly hard to do for politicians because of the punishment they might get from the citizens who elect them.
Yes, that is increasingly what we're seeing, is that for a candidate who is unwilling to appeal to whatever is popular for his or her constituency, primary constituency, they're increasingly afraid to cross the aisle. We repeatedly see candidates punished for compromising principles. And in a way, this is one of the legacies of what we've had in the 20th century. The more and more people demand their way, the way they want, what their outcome is as they see it, the less willing they are to compromise with people they see as on the other side of the aisle or even immoral. And part of what I address is how that dynamic of seeing the people you disagree with as immoral or even evil gets in the way of trying to compromise for democratic politics.
We're talking with Jeffrey Becker. He's the author of the book Ambition in America, talking about citizens, political representatives, and the divide, maybe growing divide, between them.
And you can join the conversation. Are you suspicious of people with political ambition? Would you run for elected office? If you are in office or have run for office, what motivated you? And why do you think we're skeptical when it comes to politicians? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Jeffrey Becker, author of Ambition in America, Political Power and the Collapse of Citizenship.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a blanket distrust for politicians and elected officials? If not, why do you think a lot of people do? Would you run for office? Have you run for office? What motivated you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Jeffrey, you mentioned that citizenship, political participation can ebb and flow. Do you worry, though, that we might move past some kind of breaking point that ultimately threatens representative government in our country?
Well, that's what I fear we're at right now. I fear we're at a point where many citizens look at the electoral arena and say, I don't want to be a part of it, or I don't have anything to contribute. I'm not a millionaire. I'm not a billionaire. It's easier just to focus on my private life. And that's the fear I have, is that we may be coming to a point where our elected officials lose contact with the kind of lives most of us live. Most of these officials that people don't trust have a disconnect with the people they represent. And I think that's part of the problem that I'm trying to describe, is a culture of celebrity allows us to put any values we want on these candidates, and those values might not be the ones we share, or they might not be the ones that the community in which we live shares. And that disconnect, I think, is a threat to democracy in the American Republic right now.
So one way of thinking about it is people go into politics for good reasons, but because the system of compromise and maybe corruption is inherently bad, it taints them. It makes them into bad people no matter where they started. Is there something to that?
Well, that's I think, one of the symptoms of a culture where we expect people to just realize our perfect values. And I think if we're training citizens to realize that compromise is part of the democratic process, that's not what we learn. What we learn is, I want my way, I want my rights, I want everything the way I want it. That focus on the self, I think, leads people to not want to compromise or not see compromise as a good thing, that you have to compromise with people you live with. You have to compromise with people in whom you share a town, you share a community, you work with. And I think we're moving away from a culture where people see themselves as wanting to compromise, being willing to compromise, or respecting people who actually craft at the legislative level compromises across two different parties.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Kurt on the line in Plover. Kurt, hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I don't take part in the democratic process simply because I believe anybody who wants to run for office should be disqualified due to insanity.
Kurt, thanks for the call. I mean, that's maybe not an uncommon thought. Who would want to subject themselves to that process and then do the work once they're there?
Well, I like Kurt's point because that's exactly where many Americans see themselves. The people who want to run for office are not people many of us would want to govern us. And I think a lot of that comes from, well, what are those traits of ambition? If we never are teaching people how to run for office, traits of ambition that we respect, then I think Kurt describes where many of us are. If you want to run for office, I instantly don't trust you. You seem like somebody who wants something from me and not somebody who I see as part of my culture, somebody who represents me or my values, which I think is part of the problem.
Okay, so Jeffrey, how do we get all those other people to take the idea of running for office seriously?
Well, the solution that I offer up is that a revision political parties that actually link our elected officials, that link public office with the daily lives of citizens, offers one possibility. If you are participating in public life, if you're participating in local governments, if candidates have to work their way up through local offices as opposed to, you know, entering that process at the senatorial level, at the presidential level, you may have more of a sense of connection between the candidates who are actually running for office and the communities of which they come. Historically, people, at least in ancient Athens, were elected office by lottery. I don't think we can go back that way, but there needs to be a sense that each of us has an obligation to participate in public life or at least see public questions as something that we ought to weigh in on.
We're talking to Jeffrey Becker. His new book is Ambition in America, Political Power and the Collapse of Citizenship. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you trust people who run for office? Would you run for office yourself? Do you think there's something about our political process that is inherently corrupting? What would you do to fix it? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email talk@wpr.org. And following up that last point you made, Jeffrey, it sounds like a lot of the core problem that you've talked about with celebrity politicians, with outsider politicians, is a lack of connection, both to the communities they, in theory, serve, but also to other politicians, other elites that they might have to compromise with.
Yes, I think that part of what we have breaking down is a sense that the lives we lead are connected to our political system. We look at people on the national stage and we don't really know them. They don't seem as though people that espouse values that we recognize, or that they don't live lives that most of us can know. I mean, I live in California and I know who Scott Walker is. Is that a function of me growing up with Scott Walker? No, I've never met the man. I don't know the community from which he comes. But there are these elected officials who take on these national profiles. Anybody can now post their own material on the internet and develop a national following. But is that a following connected to where they live their lives, connected to the community physically, geographically, where they live? And I think it's that lack of connection connected with this kind of celebrity culture that creates this sort of disconnect, that creates a culture of celebrity that leaves little room for the average citizen to meaningfully contribute to public life.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Melinda on the line in Trempealeau. Melinda, hi.
Hi. I was just on to say I had run for office before at coroner, and it's really strange to be running for an office like that. You wouldn't think you'd have to run for coroner. And then besides, you have to run Republican or Democrat or independent or whatever, and that should not be a political office, and especially because it goes nowhere.
And did you have to be a politician and go door to door and everything else a candidate for a city council might do?
Oh, yeah. Parades. You hold the kissing the baby thing, the handing the pamphlets out, the whole work, yeah.
All right, Melinda, thanks for the call. Maybe not coroner, Jeffrey, but do we need to put more weight on our local offices to get people in at that level?
I like the fact that Melinda really introduces that local, what a local campaign is like. It's going door to door, meeting people. And that, my guess is that the people who supported Melinda got to know Melinda. I don't know Melinda, but I imagine that the people who were supporting her for that office had a better sense of who she was. And I think that you wouldn't get the kinds of criticisms of a local official like that than you get of national officials. Now imagine hypothetically that if Melinda works her way up, regional offices, state offices, carefully, the longer she's in politics, the more people know who she is, where she comes from, what she stands for, and the less mistrust there might be for a candidate like that. I think that a political party that tries to cultivate local candidates like that, that tries to base its recruitment efforts on getting local candidates like that, has a stronger connection to the local communities, has a stronger connection to practices of daily democracy.
Linda, thanks for the call. We'll go to Dorothy in Milwaukee now. Dorothy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was on the county board in Milwaukee County for 20 years, and I was county treasurer for 5 after that. My experience was that, again, like Melinda, I went door to door, and I had already a base in the community. I was about 30, I think, when I first ran. And I already had a base in the community, so I had a whole slew of volunteers that were willing to help. And that does make a tremendous difference because we had worked on community issues together. They knew me. They knew like what my orientation was towards the community and towards politics. And going door to door was just, it was a wonderful experience. Mm. I loved it. But I got out of politics. I would have stayed in longer, but I got out of it because I was sick and tired of being verbally abused. I was really sick and tired of the incivility from my colleagues, because that's kind of when I began to notice it, was in the late 1990s.
Dorothy, thank you for the call. Jeffrey, just 30 seconds left. Can we make politics a little nicer to keep people in it?
I think Dorothy really highlights what the challenge is. You get people who want to run. They've got a clear base of support. But when they start to encounter really virulent criticism, that people no longer want to run. So what does that leave us with? People who are ambitious enough to withstand that kind of criticism. And those kinds of people might not be the best kinds of people to govern in a democratic republic.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jeffrey Becker. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of the Pacific. His new book is Ambition in America, Political Power, and the Collapse of Citizenship.